Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to episode 148 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And for this episode of the podcast, we are coming to you live from the Water Rats in London. Look at that. A brilliantly well-trained audience. Thank you. Now, this venue is pretty famous. It hosted Bob Dylan's very first UK gig in 1962. The Pogues' first gig in 1982. You're probably there, Peter, I think, for that.
You might have been, yeah.
And Oasis's first London gig in 1994, along with a roll call of other household names throughout the years. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by a photographer who captured images of the Style Council before we even knew that they would be the Style Council. Now, I'm aware that there are plenty of fans of The Jam in the room, so this might not be the most popular of guests at times, right? But you know, please give him some leeway. If you look at those sleeves of those early singles, that Café Bleu album cover, the first time you saw Paul and Mick together in France, snaps taken before the band had even been revealed to us. And he also took amazing, incredible photos of music icons such as Madonna, Iggy Pop, Marvin Gaye, Joe Strummer, David Bowie, Jagger, Depeche Mode, Herbie Hancock. The list is endless. My goodness me. Ozzy Osbourne, and we'll get to that story in a bit. And of course, the best band in the fucking world, The Jam. Yay! Please welcome my guest, Peter Anderson. Yay! Now, Peter, here we are live in London. How different is the London now to the London when you arrived? Because as people will hear in a second, you're not a native from these parts, right?
I've spent more of my life in London than I have anywhere else. So I think I'm from London.
You call yourself a Londoner?
Yeah.
You came down from Glasgow in what, 78, 79?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was London like then compared to Glasgow? What was the difference? Why did you come?
I came, from a fairly, at the time, fairly miserable city. And although not all completely miserable, but a lot of it was miserable. And it was, came to London, bright lights, big city. That was it, the story. It's a real cliche. And there's so many people from all over the world will come to London. And that's what makes London so good. It's a sort of real cosmopolitan city. And I think it still goes on and keeps going on. The fact that, you know, in all the dreadful sort of political upheaval we have, it's that London is a city full of a lot of different people that get on with each other a lot of the times. And that's what I loved about London. I still love about London. The one thing for me when I came to London from Glasgow was that, you know, I was really very much a sort of music fan, and in Glasgow at the time there was a really odd sort of bylaw that no landlord could charge admission to a pub. So basically the pubs all had a guaranteed drinking clientele, so they didn't need to be on entertainment, so there was no bands in pubs. And I came to London and there it was in front of me everywhere I could go. I could go to the, you know, all the pubs around Islington or Camden or wherever, and there'd be amazing bands playing. Just go there, and it's so exciting. And, you know, from being in Glasgow, this thing about the only music I ever really saw was occasional things at sort of specialist places, but it was just big gigs in the what used to be called the Greens Playhouse, then became the Apollo, which is a massive big venue of, you know, which I saw all the exciting bands at the time in the late 70s. And it was, you know, seeing Blondie and Television, The Clash, a lot of them all, it was so exciting. So to come to London and go to a gig in a small pub, you know, the size of this, it was brilliant. So I just started taking a camera with me and made photographs.
Now, we'll talk about some of these stories in a second with the camera, but the photography was a thing back in Glasgow as well, right? You'd gone to... No? So it's just something you picked up in London?
Yeah.
But you knew what you wanted to work in the arts in some way.
I'd been to art school in Glasgow, which is quite exciting. Actually, that was one of the places where I saw a very exciting band and completely the excitement of what should have been in Glasgow, but it was so rare to see. And it was like, I saw a band called Johnny and Self Abusers, and, you know, and Jim Kerr of Johnny and Self Abusers did somersaults and backflips up the wall. Johnny and Self Abusers became Simple Minds.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. There's me laughing away at the time. That's incredible. And you saw The Jam back in Glasgow?
Yeah.
So you were a fan of that type of music, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I also saw The Jam in Manchester and probably 78 or 79. And I was really, it was just quite impressed with it. The fact that there had been all this sort of punk things around. And then there was a few other bands would stand out that weren't punk. For example, you know, seeing Television in Glasgow, but Television being, you know, almost booed off because they were just so different and they were just all in their dark suits and things. But then the opposite of that was to see The Jam in Manchester, so exciting, but they were all in red suits. And that was quite good.
And the music scene in London, I mean, it's like gigs every night.
Oh, yeah, gigs all the time. Yeah, all the time.
So what made you start thinking, I'll sneak in my camera, I'll start taking shots?
I'd actually enrolled at a college course and it was very much a sort of... self-structured course, I suppose. So you had to make up what you wanted to do. And I decided that I want to make photographs. I imagined that I probably wanted to be a fashion photographer, but, you know, I wasn't involved in fashion. I didn't really know how to go about doing that. And I just decided I want to make photographs of people in London. And I think, you know, I was a music fan. I love music. So it was really exciting and easy to go and go to a pub, see a band and make some photographs. And then very quickly I turned it into a profession, which was amazing, actually.
I like the fact that these are bands that you would have wanted to see anyway.
Yeah, oh yeah, very much. And then bands I would want to see anyway, but also there'd be a lot of bands that I would never imagine of seeing, but I was given the opportunity to see them because I was sent out to make some photographs of them.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. And that sort of continued for, you know, quite a long time, really.
We'll talk about, I mean, literally going all over the world, taking photographs of huge stars. But let's talk about that first paid gig. How did you first come about selling your photographs, doing this for a bit of cash?
I'd started, you know, I said, going out to pubs and clubs and making a few photographs. And I decided that, you know, maybe there was a way of, I had not really any business sense or anything, still don't have, but I just thought that there must be some way I could find a way of getting these photographs used. So I actually went to the NME office and I had a bundle of photographs and probably in a bag or something like that. And, you know, really fortunate that I saw the assistant editor at the time and showed him photographs I had. And he said, oh, you went to that gig. We need that photograph. You know, in 2 days' time, that photograph was published in NME. And it was actually it was at a two-tone gig and it was the Body Snatchers in Camden Electric Ballroom and supporting the Body Snatchers was the Nips and the Nips was Shane McGowan.
Yeah.
And so from having done that and they liked his photographs I had and published them, then, you know, next week I got a phone call, we're going to do a job. I think it was probably a bit of a sort of test to see if I could deal with it and I did deal with it. And I suppose the sort of, in hindsight, if I think about it, it was really exciting, but it was also quite nerve-wracking because I had to make some photographs of the Stray Cats and I had to meet them before a gig and it was in Hogmanay and I wasn't very sure about Hogmanay and, you know, where I wanted to be, but I didn't think I wanted to be at that particular gig because I didn't really know that much about it all. But I went, I met the Stray Cats, made the photographs in a stairwell at the back of the venue in Victoria and it was a cover story in NME, so that started it. So once I had a cover story, then, you know, every week I was given jobs. Soon started that I was out and about and away from just all the excitement of the pubs, but I was having to find a way of working with journalists and going finding bands and making photographs. And then quickly after that, I started more or less sort of traveling around the world making photographs for NME, which is amazing, really. A really amazing time because the photographs were used so well in that paper and I think it was quite inspiring for a lot of people, actually. Not just from the point of view of the music, it was also Enemy at that time, I think early 80s, was a newspaper, but it was it didn't cover just the pop or the rock news events. It covered a lot of politics and fashion, and it was quite inspiring thing. But it was also before all the sort of Sunday supplement type papers would have music news, and before all the teenage magazines came out with music news. And so it was a place where people went for music news. It was either Enemy or Melody Maker or Sounds and in this country. And but gradually, I did also work for the other papers, which would be in New York. There was Spin magazine. I worked for New York and quite a lot of things.
Music press at the time was like your Bible, and it came out weekly. So the amount of content they're having to churn around every single week.
Yeah, and I think when I mentioned the thing about, in hindsight, I really like the idea that the Enemy really did cover politics. And, and that leads on to the fact that, people like Paul were totally involved in politics. And, I'd be sent to cover a Rock Against Racism convention in Trafalgar Square. So I was taking photographs of people who were politicians standing talking. And so I wasn't just making photographs of a band around the corner. And that was quite exciting, really. I'd be sent to, in the early days, he was brilliant in London and did a lot for London, I would be sent to make a portrait of Ken Livingstone. It's all really good stuff, actually. Really interesting.
How did you feel when the Jam came to an end? Did you feel that so many people in this audience will talk about the Jam being their band. I'm guessing it wasn't a similar thing for yourself, right? Because you're seeing different bands every night, for goodness sake.
I wouldn't say I ever really became a fan of any particular band. I love so many bands. I love so much music, and I loved a lot of different attitudes about it all. And I didn't become a fan, but deep down, I suppose I really loved punk music and I loved guitar music, and I still do. And the Jam never, as of when I was having all these commissions for Enemy, and I was never commissioned to photograph the Jam. But it was near the end. It was 1980. I started working in Enemy, so it was almost becoming near the end of the Jam. But I never encountered them, so to speak, except for one commission where I had to make live photograph of the Jam, and it was probably almost their last gig, and it was in the National Ballroom in Kilburn, probably 82, 81, 82 or something. It was a typical sort of thing of going to see a band, loving the idea of the band, but still had to make a photograph. And the National Ballroom in Kilburn, not an easy place to make photographs. And it was just a bit like, I don't know, maybe some of you were there. And I don't know, but everyone was just like jostling at the front. And that's the same thing. You go with a camera and you're jostling at the front, but you're trying to block people's view to try and make a photograph. It was just the way that you had to take part and be part of the crowd to make the photograph. And so I would never really go to gigs with a lot of equipment. I would always just want to go with a camera if I could. Sometimes I would have to use a flash because it was so dark. And I remember the National in Kilburn didn't have very good lighting at all. And there was no digital photography. So if you're using film and a camera, there was obstacles involved. That a digital camera phone can make amazing photographs. It can capture so much light, but an old style camera with film, hard to do sometimes, especially when you're photographing a moving subject and you're moving yourself. You're jostling the crowd with the camera like this, and the band's playing moving, and it's hard. But I actually did make a photograph of Paul from that gig that I actually like. And
is this the one where he's got Lonsdale on his, really cool, like black t-shirt, Lonsdale writing on. It's really cool. But you're also one of the few people who got photos with Paul of that gap. And actually, probably, if you think about it, the only time really where Paul's almost without a deal, or without a band, if you like. So that gap where the band, the Jam has split, the announcements happened, and then there was the Christmas, so 1982 Christmas, double issue of NME, right? And Weller's on the front cover, but the Jam are no more. The Style Council haven't yet been revealed, announced. You've not done any work with them. So this is Paul on his own.
And that was quite interesting because it was a special edition of Christmas edition of Enemy, and they did at that time, and they made a big deal about it, and they made it twice as thick, and they actually printed it. It was one of the early covers that are printed in colour, because Enemy had always been black and white, and they started printing things in colour, but it was not brilliant. The technology wasn't there, so the print and they did colour wasn't brilliant for the first year or so. And I was asked by commissioned by Enemy, would I make a photograph of Paul Weller for this Christmas issue, and it was to be something special because it was a Christmas issue. And so it wasn't a story where it was following a new release or news of what the Jam were up to, whatever, because the Jam, it was definitely decided the Jam wasn't a gone, I think. And as well as the fact of I was to make a photograph for the Christmas special of Enemy cover, it was also a sort of slight, you know, a sort of introduction manipulation by the PR officer at Polydor, who suggested that maybe it would be quite good for me to meet Paul. And I think it was that. It was a test to see if I could get on with them. And then they would ask me to make photographs when the Steel Council happened. So obviously it was quite a fun thing to do, because Paul had this idea that we should make photographs. And it was a sort of parody on the whole idea of the Avengers. And so I met him in central London, Polydor record label office. And it was not particularly good weather, but not too bad. And we decided it would be quite good to go outdoors and just make some photographs. So we did all these improvised, all these photographs of he with his partner Jill in ambush around corners, and I would be sneaking around behind him, making quick snaps of them dashing from one imaginary scenario to another. And then we'd do photographs at the sort of Barbara Hitler statue of down by Victoria, where Paul would be posing with a bowler hat and an umbrella. And then the whole culmination of it was we went back to an office and got the bottle of champagne, and the bottle of champagne was sort of thrown down the table, and the bowler hat and the bunches of flowers. It was all a big sort of spoof and fun thing. And, you know, and from my point of view, it was quite good fun doing the whole thing. All these jobs, you get your head into a job and you've got to do it. You've got to keep thinking this is not just a total fun laugh. You've got to make sure you get the photograph at the end of the day. So there's always that side of it. But I did really get on well with Paul.
And where did that idea come from? When we talk about Avengers, I should explain our younger listeners. This isn't Iron Man and the Incredible Hulk and things like that. We do have a couple of younger listeners. This is that the Avengers of the 60s, 70s, John Seed and all that, right? Was that Paul's idea? Your idea?
Paul's idea. Yeah.
Do you know why? Did you ask why?
No, I don't remember asking why. It was just sort of, it was really good to actually go and meet somebody who has an idea that they want to do something. Because quite often it could be imagined that there would be a lot of art direction and photographs of musicians at that time, but there wasn't. An awful lot of the stuff was just busked and nobody really commissioned people all that well. And so you just had to, well, for me, the side of things I worked at, it was just a case of meeting somebody to make a photograph of them, have to improvise on the spot of the scenario we were in, and probably still what had to be got out of the job at the end of the day. This was brilliant. It was like, go and meet Paul Weller, and he has this idea, he wants to do something, and he's already got the props. He's got the umbrella and the bowler hat, and so, you know, exciting, and we just go out and do it, and it's London.
One of the things I liked reading in research about your approach is that you're always really collaborative with the artists, sometimes to the detriment of the record company, right?
Yeah.
It's not just you're coming in with your vision and you're putting your stamp on it. It's actually, you want to work, and you worked a lot with Simon and Paul when we get to the Steel Council. It wasn't just you, right?
No, I think the Steel Council photographs were very much improvised at the end of the day, but they all had a starting point, and the starting point was probably a meeting in a cafe with Paul and Paula Hugh and Simon Halfin, who was a designer, and it would just all be talked about what we're going to do. And quite often the conversation didn't need to go very far. It would just say, all right, we're doing it this day, then go and we'll do it. And that was it. And the results are, there's a lot of photographs of the Steel Council in that first 2 years of their existence, and they were used so well, and they're just all over the place. There was fly posters, there was large fly posters, there was flyers, adverts and magazines. You know, there was special editions of records and marketing that went to Japan quite a lot. And it was not always worked out. A specific photo session was for a record. It was quite often quite loose. It was just when there was an opportunity to go and make a lot of photographs, they would all be done.
So they weren't necessarily going, here's single number one, this is what we want to do, here's single number two. A lot of these, and we'll go through some of the artwork, a lot of these were shot out of sequence in terms of when the release came.
Exactly, yeah.
So let's talk about that first trip. So Northern France, and we're still not quite sure where, neither of us, me from research or Peter from memory, remember exactly where. So this is the next job we're going to see if we can work out. But Northern France, and this is before the Steel Council have been revealed. Nobody knows about the band. Had you heard any of the music or?
Not at that point.
No, you didn't know anything. So you just knew you were going to Northern France.
We just knew we were going to Northern France, and it was an entourage of us all. And we were going and we would make photographs and make up some ideas of it along. But at the same time, you know, I knew how we could work probably by the way that I would work. And some of it, apart from, there was some specific photographs made which were in, it was in a very quiet town, northern France. I can't remember, somewhere near Boulogne. It was winter, January, end of January, and it was cold and grey and miserable, and the day didn't last very long.
You might as well stay there.
But it was actually to be doing something different. It was to be not in London. It was to be European. No distractions. It was just to go and make photographs.
Can you remember who went on the trip with you?
Quite a few people went. There was Simon, the designer, went. There was Paul and Mick, and there was... I don't think Paula went.
Because Paula Hewitt was like Paul's best mate, but also NME journalist at the time as well, right? Yeah. So, and I'm guessing Paul's girlfriend.
Yeah. And a few people from the record company. Paul's manager and...
Okay. It's quite secret though, isn't it? So, I mean, these days you'd have had to sign like an NDA to not reveal this, because nobody knows about the Style Council being a band yet. So you're, but some of these shots got, and purposely leaked, you would have thought, but some of the shots got leaked and it was just the Paul bit. We haven't yet seen Mick. We didn't know Mick was teaming up with Well or anything, but.
The way I quite liked making photographs at the time, I suppose I was quite interested in documentary photographs. So I mentioned that the fact that I would, go to gigs in all the small clubs and pubs in London and make photographs of bands. But I was also really interested in making photographs of just everyone in the pub. So I had quite a lot of photographs that could actually get used. And, you know, think that for some situations, people would be beginning to have some sort of identity. You know, it's like, you know, the one that I mentioned, one of the first photographs that I used, I went to this two-tone night, which was the Body Snatchers played at, which was in Camden. And so that was the beginning of people having an identity. And then maybe the next week I would be making photographs in Canning Town of the Angelic Upstarts. And so it'd all be the sort of heavy punks there. And so I would make photographs of the punters as well as the bands, which was sort of a thing that became, at the time, nobody was particularly interested in, but it suddenly became an issue a few years later. And suddenly there was all these magazines like The Face and ID sprung up, and ID had the identity photographs of somebody being stopped in the street and photographed what they're wearing today, and, you know, are they involved in some sort of fan or a cult or whatever. And that sort of early days, I had photographed quite a lot of people just like that. So going and doing a photo session with this mysterious jam, not Style Council, not jam. Apart from trying to make some photographs of Paul and Mick as if it was a definite photo session for some sort of marketing, I also would just hang out. So short days, cold, we go to a bar. There was still this sort of lingering imagery of what everyone did in a bar or whatever, the imagery of what could have been mods or whatever. And so there was photographs of Paul and Mick at pinball machines, and photographs of them in a cafe. And, you know, there was photographs of the French locals at the bar, and I would just get Paul to just sort of lean in by the bar, and he would have a cup of coffee and that at the bar, and there were drinks as well. But so it was very much a sort of, I used to work a lot, I suppose, I've said, you know, make documentary photographs, but also made photographs where I quite liked the idea of which again became popular afterwards, but not at the time. But the way that I quite liked to work, it was almost like I was making what I used to call it, an organized snapshot. So I loved the idea of just of capturing a moment of people. So it looked like a snapshot, but it was organized to do that. So it was very much organized that Paul would be at the bar with a cup of coffee in a pub, talking to the guys behind the bar. And he would have a French newspaper and sit in the corner of the cafe the next morning. And that sort of feel of it all continued. And it continued when we went and did the big massive session that had a lot of use in different marketing and everywhere, which was, we went to Paris the following year, I think it was.
Yeah, well, we'll get onto that. Let's show some of these pictures. So this single here is 40 years old now. The first, Speak Like a Child, the first single. And obviously the front cover, this isn't out on 12-inch. They should have reissued it, shouldn't they, this year? Anyway, didn't come as a 12-inch, just as a 7-inch. Speak Like a Child. The front cover, we just had a black sleeve. And then on the back, your shot.
And I think it was very intentional. It was going to be a low-key single. Remember that all being talked about, so it wouldn't have an image. Apart from when we did the photo sessions, I would, you know, meet up with Paul and we'd talk about it, and Simon. I also worked quite closely with Simon, who was a designer, and I would just give him all his photographs I'd taken, then he had to sort of try and work out how he would use them. And I think that he found it quite difficult, the idea. It was just going to be a non-image for the Style Council when there was all these photographs. So they decided to put one on the back of the sleeve, which is quite good. And that was one photograph which I actually really liked. And in a way, it was for me, it was like something different. It wasn't just this idea of capturing a frantic moment of a band playing in a pub or something like that. And it was in the streets. It was always the same thing. I was always making challenges for myself. And getting dark, I'd use a long lens, but the whole idea of the long lens and making Paul walking down the street makes it difficult because it's movement and focus and dark. And but I really like that photograph still. I think it stands up as a sort of slightly fashion type photograph.
Also couldn't look any different from that Jam look either, right? So the Mac is a consistent in some of these photos. I assume that the next one, Money Go Round, I've got the 12 inch here, the Money Go Round shot was from the same shoot, but actually this was in the UK, right?
Yeah it was. I can't remember where it was a TV program. The TV program was based in somewhere out of London, north of London. Can't remember what studio it was. It was almost like a stately home used as a recording studio. But as for a TV recording studio, not music recording studio. So that was a photo session where the Style Council had to be there a certain time, certain place. They're going to be there, and everyone's really busy all the time. So they knew that they had to do this. So they would allocate a few hours and say, "Could I come and make some photographs for the idea for another session, for another single, probably?" And so we did it in the grounds of the recording studio.
Oh, I see. So this isn't just like a random recreation ground.
No. And I think it was, the idea was to do something a bit sort of lighthearted and a bit fun. So it's the idea that it actually relates back to the John Steed photographs. So it's a bit like, the Avengers. It's in ambition. And there are other shots where they're sort of sneaking around behind hedges and poking out and chasing each other and running up steps of the grounds of the garden. They're just all fun. The other thing is that to me it was always quite apparent that in the media, not necessarily within the band and the fans, whatever, but in the media, I think the Jam, it was always a bit sort of po-faced and serious, and Paul was very serious. But it was just brilliant. We did all these photographs. It was just all so much fun and lighthearted, and it was just all tongue-in-cheek all the time.
Let's talk about that trip to Paris, which resulted in so many shots that are used throughout album cover, singles, all this kind of stuff, right? So an entourage, you go, and at this point, the Style Council have been revealed. The band are a band. And Paul had this vision where he was going to go to a different European country. I don't know if you know this, go to a different European country. So next on the agenda was going to be Austria, I think, and they were all going to be in ski suits. But we only ever had A Paris, this incredible EP. But talk to me about the Paris trip.
We went to Paris, and I can't remember if we went twice, or it was stretched out, because there was two reasons why the Style Council in Paris. They were actually recording record in Paris, and they played a gig, a sort of low-key gig in a jazz club. And that was the whole thing about the whole Café Bleu. And this based on sort of soul and jazz music and blues, I suppose. And maybe that was just separate. There was that was the reason why we went there, because they were already there. And so I went there to meet them, and then we spent a few, we did a lot of photographs in Paris, but it was all done over a very short time spell. It was like a morning, an afternoon, and at night. And Paul and Mick had just totally professional about it all, that they're there, they're available, and then they leave it up to me to do something. We were in the center of Paris, so then it was just up to me to really work at it and get as many photographs as possible, and try to do things that showed that they were different and they were the Style Council that they were in Paris. So there's the images with the Eiffel Tower, and probably, I mean, apart from that one, which has got the Eiffel Tower in the background, sort of out of focus, but that also went with the whole, to me, the style of the photographs. It was trying to make something different. And there was probably one of my favourite photographs out of that, which were used as one of the large fly posters, which were around at the time. I think they were sort of illegal, but they were there anyway. And there was a few years where the record companies put out fly posters all the time, and they wouldn't put their names on them because they would get caught or something, but they were there. And there was a really big fly poster, which was the Eiffel Tower in the background and Paul's shoe in the foreground, and his hand beside his shoe with his bracelet. So you knew exactly that that was Paul Weller, but no face. That was instigated by me, I suppose. And it was just like, I loved fashion photographs. although I wasn't doing fashion photographs, but I loved them, and I loved the idea of some of the fashion photographers like Irving Penn or William Klein, who were not traditional fashion photographers, but they made amazing fashion photographs, and that's what inspired me, I suppose. But then also the idea of these other sleeves, which were in Paris, you know, the idea of being at the Arc de Triomphe and just at night to make photographs at night, and had that sort of feel of something European, and to me that feels a bit like it could be sort of Italian style of the ragazzi or something, and it's that sort of feel of it all.
They certainly got, I mean, they got their money's worth from the material, didn't they? Yeah. You said they took a lot, but they used it in so many different places, on albums, covers, singles, and that. This is introducing the Style Council. This was like a little mini LP that came out, but not over here. It was Holland and Japan, and then imported. The Japanese version has Paul and Mickey in a poppy field. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was. That was a completely spur of the moment thing, that we were on a bus coming back from Paris, and we stopped, and there were just these fields, and I just said, oh, let's go and make some photographs of the fields or something like that. And then it just was Paul and Mick larking around in this field, and it could almost be, you can imagine it being something like, it's got a different undercurrent because it's a poppy field, but, you know, you could almost imagine it just being like sort of a military advert or something. And you know, I don't think anyone would have imagined that Paul Weller of The Jam would be larking around in the field like a military advert. And I think that's brilliant. I think it's so funny.
Dennis Mundy went on this second trip, yeah. Right?
Dennis Mundy was the first trip too.
Oh, okay. He wrote this. I wanted to ask you about this, right? So he was talking about the final night. Can you remember this? So the final night.
In Paris.
Yeah, yeah. So this is Dennis. So Dennis says, it was a good trip, and it summed up the difference between The Jam and the Style Council. On the last night of the shoot, Peter Anderson and I went to an expensive bistro and enjoyed the meal so much that we were late for the session, which was taking place at midnight at the Arc de Triomphe. When we finally arrived, Kenny went into one, cursing us for keeping everybody waiting, and had a real go at us. Paul Weller turned to him and said, for fuck's sake, Kenny, give it a rest. This isn't The Jam. It doesn't matter.
It didn't matter.
But I guess that's that thing about the pressure's off, and he's really having fun, and he wanted that to come through with all of the crew as well, right?
Yeah, that's what I'd forgotten about that, but that's what I meant about the professionalism of him doing it. Because it wasn't like, you know, I actually met quite a lot of bands and quite a lot of musicians, and sometimes it was oh, we got to do this photo session. Oh, I'd rather be smoking a joint. I'd rather be doing this. I'll just light up and I'll just sit in the corner, and just like Paul was just like, we want to make the photograph. So that was it. We'd actually been out at the Eiffel Tower at something like 9 a.m. and started making photographs, because that photograph, you can see, it's first light of the morning. And then we went and made loads of photographs of sitting around cafes, which it seems like, oh, maybe that's just lazy or something like that, but it's not. It's to make a really good image. And as much as I said this thing about organized snapshots, it was just very much of Paul and Mick would be sat at a cafe, and there'd be a lot of other people at the cafe, but trying to avoid the other people in the photograph and trying to make it look realistic. It was all hard work for everyone, not just for me. It was hard work for Paul and Mick and whoever. So what happened then was we'd start at 9 a.m. with those photographs, a lot of photographs, and a lot of tramping around central Paris, and then that was it. We were still to be back out at midnight.
A bollocking from Kenny Wheeler.
So Dennis Mundy made me late.
I mean, there must be that buzz as well of having your artwork used on singles and albums that are still, I mean, these, you know, you don't get this with Spotify with a little thumbnail, right? So 40 years later, we're looking at this artwork.
And it's funny just actually thinking about it, forgetting things like Dennis and me eating a big dinner. I forgot about that. But then it was just, so much of it just seems 40 years ago. But I didn't remember it all.
Did you get to go anywhere else abroad with the Style Council?
No. We did a lot of photographs around London and whatever, but then, and walking.
So there are two video shoots that you attended.
Yeah.
Actually, talk us through this. So this is Solid Bond in Your Heart, obviously. The video recorded in somewhere we're all going to be, actually, probably everybody in this room at the end of June for a special event on the Style Council and The Jam and that. But this was the video shoot for that, which you went along to take pictures as well, right?
The club was set up like as a club. And then there was, during the video, there was invited audience, and there was dancing and thing and filmed. And there was also a scenario outside it where there was cars and scooters and you know, my part of it was make some photographs at the place. So you can't make photographs when the video's been shot. So it was like in between times, I would have to get Paul and Mick to spend some time with me and make some photographs. And at that time, I'd made quite a lot of photographs with Style Council. And the more that do, I would probably quite like the idea of taking chances and trying to do something different and something that would work, but would also be inspiring for me. And so I took a strange panoramic camera with me, which was the lens moves and it gives a really wide angle lens without distortion, a wide angle panoramic image without distortion because the lens moves. But if you use it in the wrong way, it makes really interesting distortions. And that's the sort of thing that I like to do. And there's some photographs that were made in the car park of Paul and Mick leaning over a car. And it's a bit almost like a sort of spoof of Minder or something. And the way that I made the photograph, the strange camera and too close and all the car becomes warped and their elbows become warped leaning on top of the car. And then there was also these shots which were taken in the club. It almost becomes quite a sort of abstract shot, but that was, as a record sleeve, is quite intriguing, the idea that Simon chose to have that as the that folds, but the main part of the photograph, you have to open it up really.
Yeah, so the front of it, you just see the fog, you don't see, and the windows, you don't see Paul and Mick at all, and then on the back, right?
Yeah. Then it comes up that they're at the, there's a few other photographs in that, which I actually still really have and like. And, you know, there's Mick as the DJ and then Paul standing in front of the desks and below him and Mick's picking all these records. And it's just all typical sort of brilliant soul music. It's all there. So all the record labels are there and everything.
And do these photos, I mean, they still exist, obviously, this old back catalogue of things that didn't get used. But are they yours? Are they Polydor's? Where do they, are they in Paul's vault?
Well, there's a story about that, actually. That basically, all the photographs that I made for Style Council, there was never any... I was always commissioned per job, per... Or not commissioned per job, I was commissioned on or paid by the usage of them. So if I'd done a photo session, I wasn't paid for doing that, but I was then... If they use it as a record sleeve, I'd be paid for the record sleeve. If they use it for press and publicity, I'd be paid a fee for that. So basically, I kept all the copyright of them all. I still have all the photographs. But one of the things that happened was that colour photographs were original and they were colour transparencies. They were never negatives. They were always colour transparencies at the time. And no one really stopped to make copies of the transparencies. So they were, in hindsight, they were quite sort of valuable, but a lot of them get lost. So over the years, there's been lots of things about getting together images for various projects, whether it's a, you know, a best of CD or a reissued sleeve or whatever. And obviously, a lot of the stuff bought or marketing would have had, and then they would have lost. But the one thing I always kept was I kept all the black and white negatives. I have all these. But the colour stuff was a problem because, as I said, some of it's transparent and some of it lost. But there was one time when Simon, half when the designer was trying to round up some photographs for, you know, a best of box set or something and couldn't find certain colour photographs. And he was just hopefully thinking, I might just have some or I would have copied them or something. I never made copies. No one did. It was too expensive at the time. And there was no digital, no scanners. And it was always rumoured that the best photographs, all the best colour ones, were in a suitcase under Paul's bed. So that's the question that I'll ask. If you said to me that you would ask me if once you get to interview Paul, the question is, has he still got any of these photographs under his bed?
Well, hold on to that. Remember that. We're talking about video shoots. You were on the, I think again, round Woking somewhere. This was Ever Changing Moods. This was the cycling video.
It was, it wasn't Woking. It was somewhere in North London.
Norwich.
Was it? It was Norwich. That sounds right. Yeah. It was quite a bit out of London. I think one of the things that was quite inspiring about it was that it was going to be the cycling video. And, there was a typical stately home. There was the avenue, which had trees. And the trees looked a bit like maybe French trees, as of the Tour de France going up through the trees in the French countryside or something. And it was a video shoot which was done, as video shoots get done, they get done and organised and have to get done, and they have to be done at the day they're done. And it was freezing cold and it was wet and windy. And just, you know, just think of the, again, it's just, you know, the Soil Council, Paul and Mick, totally professional. They were there and they would do it. And then and the whole video team. So I was commissioned to go along and make photographs and try and sneak, and it was So it was very much a sort of sneak photographs in between all the takes and the video. So, you know, not getting away of the video crew, but then trying to make photographs, and quite fun. There's some photographs which, you know, quite funny at the end of the day. The whole video was the cycling bit was quite sneakily done because the bikes had the front wheels taken off and the forks were bolted onto a trailer behind a car.
Oh, it's for the entire illusion. Paul was pedaling up Box Hill or something. There was one other shoot, which the front cover of the NME, June 1985. Might have been one of your last shoots with the Style Council, Paul. I don't know. And there might be a reason for this. This was Weller in the loincloth. Remember this?
That wasn't the last. That was specifically an enemy story. I can't remember what journalist did it, but the photographs were taken completely separate from the journalist doing an interview. It wasn't anything to do with anything for the record company use. It was just the enemy photo shoot. And it was actually quite good, quite a fun thing. And it was the idea was that I went and met Paul and Paolo, and we went into the woods and walking and made some photographs and Paul in the loincloth and it has a lot of war paint and imagery, which was all painted and drawn on him by me and Paolo.
But why? Did this come from... Who's this? I mean, can you imagine?
Not mine.
Swaying the guy in the jam, like you say, was always considered serious. It clearly has a sense of humour, but back then that didn't come across in the media. In his loincloth, a bit what?
I think it was a bit of a sort of parody and a bit of Lord of the Flies.
Yeah. And I imagine quite a few people here had it stuck on the bedroom bedroom wall. You know, it's a lovely shot, Paul. But yeah, the headline was Weller Goes Wild in the Pop Jungle. But clearly the article itself had no relation to the images whatsoever. And there are a couple of artists that we should talk about as well before we go. So, I mean, before the Style Council, that, you know, so much of your photography is, I mean, incredible, like Soft Cell, Depeche Mode, all these incredible bands. There was Marvin Gaye, Madonna, first time Madonna ever came to London. This is just before Holiday, so just before her kind of big first hit. These beautiful, I mean, she looks absolutely stunning, these photos of Madonna.
Quite interesting, because that was again just bust, really. It was a case of Madonna was coming and to London, and, you know, it's not the most popular act at the time, and probably also it was for me, it was a NME story, and I don't think NME, I mean, much, NME covered a lot of pop, but it was always sort of indie type pop, so that they didn't cover acts like dance acts to the same extent at that point. And so Madonna not being exactly really famous, but, you know, everyone knew, and there was a big buzz about her coming to London, I think, and I was commissioned to make a photo of Madonna, and it was on the day, it was like suddenly it was said something like 2 o'clock, oh, can you go and meet Madonna, Broadwick Street, the record company office, and make some photographs? That was it. Got to the record company office and, oh, Madonna's not here, she's out. And wait around. And then Madonna comes back from just sort of, you know, being out in London, doing some shopping or something. And so I'm introduced to her and said, oh, make some photographs. And PR woman had a brilliant idea. She said, oh, maybe you could just go up on the roof of the record company office. And perfect. And Madonna said, oh, can you wait, you know, just wait for a little while. And just briefly, she said she wanted to put on some makeup. So she did her own makeup. We went on the roof and she just danced down the roof for me. So I just made photographs of her dancing on the roof. Brilliant.
What a job. You're getting paid for that. Incredible. The Rolling Stones, Haircut 100, Iggy Pop, Talking Heads. I mean, these artists are just incredible. I need to ask you about Ozzy Osbourne. We mentioned earlier on about how your vision for photography wouldn't always align with a record label and things like that, right? Tell me the Ozzy story.
The Ozzy story was, obviously the way that things worked was that there would be, if an act was going to release a record in this country, then there would have to be, you know, pre-publicity, pre-interviews to back it all up, to introduce it all. And, you know, Ozzy Osbourne's traveling around the world, so journalist and photographer sent to meet Ozzy before he comes here. And so I was sent with a journalist to Sacramento, interviewing photographs with Ozzy Osbourne, and got there, and the entourage around Ozzy was not very happy that Ozzy wasn't in a very good state, and he didn't look very good, and he wasn't... He was a nice guy, and we sat in the bar and had a good laugh with him and had drinks with him. But the the record company people just didn't want him photographed. They said he didn't look good. So I waited for something like 2 days, and eventually it was decided that, no, he would have to be photographed, they would have to do it. So literally, Ozzy was got out of his room and had his, you know, some stylist put clothes on him and propped him up and almost had to hold him up by the side of the swimming pool. And, you know, and you can tell that it's not what he wanted to do, but at the same time, he would just do it. And stressful for me at the time, but funny sort of afterwards. But I got a few photographs that I actually quite like that are still exist, and I like them. But they, and he, there was still a sparkle out of him, because he could slightly forget that he was being ordered into doing this, and he would just sort of have a laugh, and, you know, so it was okay.
There was another note, and I said to you before we started, so obviously doing research for the podcast, you get some of these stories, and I literally, all I wrote down was Beth Gibbons, Porter's Head, and I didn't write down any more than that, because I knew that prompt would remember the story for you, right?
Well, the story was that it was commissioned from a record company to make photographs of Porter's Head, and it wasn't specifically for a sleeve or any particular marketing campaign. It was just to have some photographs that they could use for marketing and for press. So Porter's Head came to my studio at the time, and it was a studio which I lived in, and lived in with my, you know, as a family. We had a family house within my studio, and it was an old it was quite, it was like a, I suppose it's like a, what people call loft living, I suppose. And there was a lot of space, and there was a lot of stuff flying around. And so there was, things were improvised when we got there. But one of the things that was, didn't instantly gel from a record company point of view was that Beth had said that she didn't want to be recognizable in the photographs. You know, which is a record company wanting to photograph their act, and she doesn't want to be recognizable. So it was almost as if she wasn't going to take part in the photo shoot, but she did. So I had to invent all these ways of trying to make photographs of two of them, but it was mostly Beth, and just how to make photographs of her, which she wasn't recognizable, which is actually a challenge and really good fun to do. But, you know, it didn't go down too well afterwards from the record company people. It was my sort of family home in a way, and we decided to do some things that would just be a spoof and a laugh, and don't really know quite how it came about, but it was decided that that Beth might at one point be photographed as if she's being sick. And I remember mixing up some of my daughter's bright blue poster paint in yogurt, and Beth had that in her mouth, and it was sick, and it made a brilliant photograph. But I just afterwards I feel so sorry for her that she had this poster paint and yogurt in her mouth. And then there was other photographs where she was pressed her face against some glass and really pressed it, and it just really made brilliant images. And the other photographs of Jeff, where he had brought his dog, and he just spent the whole time rifling through my record collection. So there's photographs of him looking at all my records with his dog on his lap, and it's quite funny. It's quite sort of a day in the life of people, but it's not what the record company wanted. And they weren't happy, I don't think. No. But there was good photographs, though. They went, you know, gradually these photographs seeped out around the world in different music magazines all over the world.
The other thing I should talk about as well, we should mention in terms of the Weller link. So many of you would have bought the singles, the compilation album, the Respond record label, which is Paul's record label as part of Polydor throughout time. And all those bands, all those acts, you were taking the photographs for them as well. So A-Craze, Tracy, The Questions, all that, yeah?
Yeah, and there was things there was photographs at that time which were, it was photographed young musicians who, you know, not used to being photographed, and you know, it was just really quite a challenge, and it was quite good to do. And there was definitely sort of feelings which had passed down through Paul and through Simon Designer, and feelings I would have, and, you know, really liked things like the images on Blue Note Records, where there's a lot of Blue Note Records where they're just everyday scenes on street scenes. It's like lots of acts just in a street, or, you know, running. Actually, there's some there was running across fields. There's a brilliant photograph of Al Green running across a field in one of the records. And it was just all things like this, but there was something that I suppose thought of as a sort of London image. So I made a whole lot of photographs with Tracy, and it was just in Hyde Park with lots of pigeons round about her. And that was quite fun to do, and it's very much sort of a London image. And then there was other photographs of a band called A-Craze, and they were all done by the Thames Embankment, with all the sort of feeling of the Thames involved in it all. And so taking that feel of Blue Note Records, which very American and making that sort of London-like. And then the records would be designed a bit like a reference would be Blue Note records.
So they were all heavily getting into that type of music as well and influencing the style cut. So.
The sleeve there. Yeah, that one. I mean, that, I suppose, is that sort of feel of a Blue Note record. Yeah. It's just a street scene. But that's one of the Paris photographs. And that actually had a bit of photographic involvement in it from me at the end, which was quite good because I used a special process to tint the photograph blue, and it was a chemical process, you know, so it's not just printed as a two-tone image, it actually is a chemically processed blue photograph.
All right. Okay. So that's the cover of My Ever-Changing Moods, the 12-inch version. The 7-inch is the one with Paul with a cigarette and the woolly hat on, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
This has been so fascinating. One thing I say for people to dig at is not just your portfolio. It seems to me you're a bit like Paul, not somebody who looks back often. You don't do these kind of things, right? and your collection kind of lives with you, but you don't even do like exhibitions very often, right?
Well, but I have done exhibitions, but the exhibitions have been all sorts of different things. And I mean, I had exhibitions about, I started trying to make some exhibitions, which were about 12 years ago or something. And I actually still have a dart room and, you know, a conventional wet dart room. Well, that 12 years ago, I actually made photographs, and it was decided I'd make big photographs. So I started making large photographs, which are about 5 foot by 4 foot, and made them in plywood dishes in the floor of my studio. So they were exhibited. Quite a lot of different things went on. But in saying that about continuing doing things and not always looking back, I actually have looked back a lot recently. And I suppose one of the things that especially for me, it was the whole COVID thing, was having to do something different. And I was doing something I couldn't continue doing. And I started to make an archive of the photographs I have and spent about, I don't know, about a year and a half. And then I stopped nearly a year ago, which I'm about to start again. But the reason I stopped was another reason, but I conscientiously decided to have an Instagram account, enthused by daughters, I suppose, and I made an Instagram account, and it was purely to make an archive of my photographs of mostly musicians that I'd photographed in the 1980s. And I did it for about a year and a half, and I posted up at least 3 photographs every day for a year and a half or something like that. And
that's a big commitment, so keep that up.
Yeah. Then I stopped. About a year ago I stopped, but I'm going to start again. So it meant that I organised and have this start of this built up of this archive.
Okay.
It is there on an Instagram account, which is peteranderson.photos.
And do you think there'll be an opportunity at some point for you to share some of the Style Council stuff that we haven't seen?
Probably.
Well, unless it's under Paul's bed, we'll go on to.
Yeah, there's some of it under his bed. I think maybe. Yeah, but I don't think I'd really got around to doing very much of the Style Counselling on his Instagram account, but that'll come. That'll be the next batch.
Hey, look, man, this has been so lovely chatting with you. I should also encourage people to dig out the short film that exists as well called Available Light. Andrew, this is one thing I should ask you about, because often you'd like to work with the available light. That's the whole point, right? It's like not the flash, not, you know, manipulating. It's whatever's there.
I think that was what the point was. I didn't explain it very well, but it was that thing about going to gigs and I only wanted to have a camera. I didn't want to go with the big silver case and all that stuff. And when I first started going out and making photographs, it was very much a conscious thing that I would have a camera. And I had a denim jacket and I could put the camera in one pocket and the lens in the other pocket. And that was fine. I suppose I had one film somewhere. And I'd also go out and that's the other thing, which it was quite noted once. And one journalist made a big thing about it. He couldn't believe the fact that I would go out to work with him and I would take a roll of film. I wouldn't take a box with 6 rolls of film or 10 rolls of film or 25 rolls of film. I'd have a roll of film. And we went out once to make some photographs and he suddenly said to me, oh, we've got 2 jobs today. So you only get half a roll of film for each. We went and we met a band called Vice Versa, who on the day we met them changed their name to ABC. And so I made some photographs of them outside an ABC cinema.
Quick thinking, God, on the same day.
And then we went to a butcher's shop in Soho and made some photographs of a Scottish band called the Fire Engines in the butcher's shop on the counter behind all the meat and the Scotch beef. One roll of film and worked.
2 questions for you before you go. Right. So you're allowed 1 Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or solo. What are you going to go with?
I think Money Go Round.
Ah, why that one?
Like the sentiment of it.
You got more as well for that, because you get the part one and part two is a longer thing, right? Is that, and I guess that was the first one where your photo was on the cover, like the front cover.
Might have been, yeah.
Okay, final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to chat to the lovely people like yourself who've got these amazing stories, these experiences with Weller, the Jam, the Style Council, whatever, right? But it's really, being honest, it's for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. It was my one big regret, so much so that I created a podcast that's now led to live events, all kinds of things. But we still need that interview with Paul Weller.
Well, I hope you get it.
Well, if it happens, what should I ask him? I think I know what's coming.
Has he still got some photographs under his bed? I think it would be quite good to ask him if, you know, for me it'd be quite good if he, you know, has memories of things like being out in Paris and making photographs. Did he have fond memories of that? Because I have.
Yeah,
and I think we did. I think we all liked doing it, and yeah, and just how they all got used. Because I mean, obviously, for Paul, it was very much. It wasn't just about the music; it was about a whole vision, I think. But you know, obviously, for him, the music's an important thing, and I just, it would be quite interesting to know that, you know, the thing, but the comment was, if Kenny was not happy about me turning up late for the photo session at midnight, Paul liked doing all that.
I'd love to
have to stand beside these fountains in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I'd love to know how many bollockings Paul Weller's had from Kenny Wheeler over the years for being late, wouldn't you?
Kenny Wheeler broke one of my sofas.
How? Kenny is a god. We love Kenny. He's been on the podcast as well, the only time he's ever talked to anybody about any of it, I think. Hey, look, this has been so lovely. Please give it up for my very special guest, Peter Anderson.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.